Welcome to Vancouver Opera Offstage. I'm your host, Les Dalla, Chorus Director and Associate Conductor at Vancouver Opera. Join me for this bi-weekly podcast as we connect with opera experts, artists, staff, and others to explore the world of opera on and off the stage. We are honored to share our stories on the unceded homelands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
Good afternoon and welcome to the podcast. I am delighted to be joined today by my good friend and colleague, J. Patrick Raftery, who is a professor of voice and opera at UBC and who has had an incredibly distinguished career as an opera singer, both a baritone and a tenor, one of the only people I know who has that distinction. And I can't wait for Patrick to tell us all about that. So without further ado, welcome, Patrick.
Hello, Les. How are you? It's good to see you and hear you, even though your audience is listening to us. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I mentioned to you, I guess, months ago that I wanted you to be on this show, and I'm sorry it took so long, but I'm glad that we're doing it now. And it makes sense, actually, to me to be able to talk now because, of course, you're a few weeks into the semester at UBC, and in this crazy year of 2020 with COVID and everything else going on, I'm dying to know how things are going out there.
Well, actually, it's going extremely well. Personally, I got online and started working with Zoom already before this whole thing happened. And my course ended with a number of Zoom meetings, and I did some teaching and convention teaching using Zoom. So I'm really familiar and very comfortable with this environment for teaching. The School of Music is actually doing a hybrid version where some of the students are having face-to-face and some of the students are virtual. And it's actually going extremely well. We have an unbelievably talented group of singers this year, especially in first year, but lots of master's level as well. So it motivates us. And I'm being very careful with teaching at home, advising all online. So I think it's very beneficial, this way of working. And I think there's a lot of content that we can cover online that you can't really always get to in the studio. But I love being with my colleagues like you. When I get a chance to sing with you when you're playing, we meld very well together. We have a little Vulcan mind meld going on. And so you kind of can't get that on Zoom the same way as you can get it in the room. But I think the students are getting a great experience.
Well, that's great to hear. I imagine the protocols are very strict in terms of when people are in the same room. I mean, I understand that Nancy is putting together this Rossini opera, which I see is on the calendar for UBC, and there are performances listed in October. Have you been able to witness any of those rehearsals or report on how that's being put together?
Actually, I haven't seen any of the rehearsals. A couple of my singers are involved, so I've been working on quite a bit of that Rossini. And years ago, there was a period of time where I was considered a Rossini specialist, which I think in retrospect is quite funny, but only because I sang The Barber of Seville so many times. But yes, I've been working with them, and I know that Nancy is being very strict with the protocols, but the protocols are almost changing. They're not changing daily, but just like for everyone else, the earth is moving underneath our feet a bit. But I know that, of course, the health and well-being of the students is the most important thing, which I think is everyone's focus.
Yeah, absolutely. And over the course of the interview, we'll come back to the students near the end, but I would now like to go back. I would love for you to tell us how you got started in music when you were growing up. Was there an aha moment that made you realize you had to become an opera singer? And what were the steps you took to make that dream a reality?
Well, I only found out much later in life when I was on a trip with my school when I was 12. And I went Paris, London, and Milan, I think, in a week. And my teacher, maybe 20 years later, told me that in the Paris trip that we actually went and saw Tosca at the Paris Opera. So I don't remember that, but I do remember coming home. And soon after my voice changed, I was just singing full voice, singing while I was mowing the lawn, singing while I was just all the time. And I'm sure that that sort of planted a seed. And I also was completely just obsessed with theater. And while my friends were building go-karts, I was building proscenium sets and flies and trying to figure out where the stage was. So I knew I was going to be working in a theater environment from a very young age. And my voice just kind of took over. And at one point when I was 14 or 15, I think, I felt like I had hurt myself. So I thought, well, if this is how I'm going to make my living at 15, if this is going to be my life, I had already decided that was going to be my life, I better get a voice teacher because I need to figure out how to protect this. So I remember that I got my driver's license when I turned 16 so that I could drive to voice lessons. So I had a very clear focus.
Wow. Is that ever a clear focus? And may I ask, I mean, that's deliberate, getting your driver's license to be able to go and have lessons. Was music a huge thing in your family home?
It really was. My mom insisted with us that we all study an instrument for a year. So during the course of a school year, we didn't have to do the same one every time. And lucky for me, I had a year of violin, a year of trumpet, a year of piano before my voice took over. I think I had maybe a very short year of percussion until my mother maybe thought that was not the greatest idea. So by the time my voice changed, I could already read music. And even though I'm not facile at playing at the keyboard, I could read all the time signatures and tempi, and all of those things were stuff that I was familiar with while I was studying theater. So my younger sister and I did a competition for one-act plays in DC, and she won for best actress, but we were both disqualified because they found out that we were under the age limit. We were actually too young to be doing it. So I did have music studies and theater happening just at the same time.
That's funny. I've never heard actually of somebody being disqualified because they were too young. I mean, certainly sometimes people, you know, would try and sneak into a category. But my whole childhood, I remember having, you know, Kiwanis Festival music competitions. And I remember the thing that was always the most humiliating was when there was somebody who was clearly 4 years younger, but was in your category, who would always win first prize. And actually, there was one particular pianist who every year without fail was always winning. And I remember it made me feel really bad until, you know, then growing up, she actually had a Deutsche Grammophon recording contract. So I thought, well, you know, I don't have to feel so bad.
No, well, I do remember that for my first driver's license, I was 6'2 and weighed 225. So I just kind of over one summer grew to be almost the same physical size that I am now. And my voice changed that quickly, too. So yeah, I was very upset that I got disqualified, but you know.
Them's the breaks. I don't think it got in your way. But
it did, completely did not get in my way. My voice took over my life, sort of. And so I followed my voice, and my voice took me in the direction of opera. And I was very comfortable with that. But all through high school, I was doing musical theater and choirs and sang sometimes solos and things. And part of the reason that I also got a voice teacher was because all of these great ensemble directors were utilizing my talent that they were recognizing, but I was the only kid in school who could sing a B-flat full voice, you know, full chest voice. So in the morning, I was often a tenor, and by the evening, I was a baritone, and I even did Gilbert and Sullivan, but I did this Gilbert and Sullivan operetta in high school, and I sang the tenor part, and in the local Doyle Cart community group, I sang the baritone part within like 2 months of each other when I was only 16 or 17. So I was just going back and forth and doing what people suggested for me to do before I realized that, okay, I have to settle down here and not jerk my voice up and down all the time.
Right. Well, obviously a very flexible and versatile instrument. That's amazing. And so then after high school and all of these performances, what happened next?
Well, there was a bit of overlap. It was one of the things that I think I took for granted. I was born in Washington, D.C. Actually, I'm one of the very few people born in Washington, D.C. There was a hospital on Pennsylvania Avenue and 25th Street. And so I'm Canadian and American. I'm a dual citizen. Very proud of that. And in my high school, I was introduced to a lot of people. And I had lessons with Todd Duncan, who was the local voice teacher, who was the original Porgy in Porgy and Bess. And I also was put before George London, who for a few years was the director of the Washington Opera. And that was also while I was still in high school. And I'm really not sure how Mr. London heard about me or made the time to give me a lesson. I don't want to say he was unpleasant with me, but he was very firm with me. And I didn't think that it went very well. But I found out also years later, my mother told me, because it had just never come up, that he called her at that time and said that I was a very talented young man and that I should be supported and that she should see that I get voice lessons. So there was a bit of overlap. And while I was still in high school, a friend of mine dared me to audition for Wolf Trap for their summer young artist program. And it was 1976. And, you know, you found out information about things for flyers and stuff. So I made the application and went in to sing for Frank Rizzo, who was also then running Washington Opera, and John Moriarty, who was one of the people who helped establish Santa Fe, but also was running Wolf Trap Summer Opera. And I just came in off the street and just sang for them at 18. And the story goes that one of them, I don't remember which one of them, said, "How old are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm 18, but I'll be 19 in 4 months." And then Rizzo said, "Oh, well, that makes all the difference, you know." And all I had done was, I had a voice teacher, but I was listening to recordings of Cheryl Milnes and then just doing what I heard Mr. Milnes doing. And so they invited me to audit Wolf Trap because they thought I was too young to be a participant, imagine, at 18. So I got to meet a whole lot of coaches and a whole lot of stage directors. Beverly Sills, I met just a whole lot of people that impacted me for many years afterwards. That was all before I went to college.
That's pretty amazing.
I mean, I was so fortunate that people were paying attention and that I also worked really hard and I took every opportunity very seriously. So I never really edited in my head a value for singing the show at my school or singing the show at Wolf Trap or in a big venue. I just took any opportunity just as seriously as the other one. And those people helped me a great deal. John Moriarty and Beverly Sills especially helped me. And while I had started in college, a friend of mine named Janice Hall was singing Gilda in Rigoletto in San Diego. And this was probably 77 or 78. So I went out to see her and she just said to Tito Capobianco, "Oh, this friend of mine is here and you should hear him." And so my aria of choice at that time was Hamlet's drinking song. And I didn't think that it was impertinent at all, but they were doing Hamlet at that time with Cheryl Milnes and Ashley Putnam. And so I went into a rehearsal room and I sang, "Oh, va, d'ici pour la tristesse." You know, I started that. He stopped me and he said, "I want to hear you on stage." So he actually took me upstage and I was 20 or maybe 21 and put me on Cheryl Milnes' set of Hamlet and had me sing it on the stage of San Diego Opera to hear me in the space. And it was just kind of an amazing experience. The young artist programs were different then than they are now and not as firmly structured, I think. And he offered me a 6-year contract of roles and San Diego Opera and Tito Capobianco. That wound up being my young artist program. And I'm sure Beverly had some influence there too. And she gave me my debut at City Opera in Puritani not very long after.
I've never heard that story. I mean, you and I have socialized on a number of occasions and talked about things, but that is amazing. I couldn't help thinking the irony of you singing "Au vin d'ici pour la tristesse" at an age before you were even legal to drink.
Exactly.
That's impressive.
And also, I was aware that I was singing, you know, on Mr. Milne's set, but I gave it my all. I thought, okay, this is my chance, you know. So I wasn't thinking in that kind of competitive way. I was such a fan of his. And when I met him later, he was always extremely nice to me. And I got a couple of the reviews that I got that were very impactful when I was young mentioned Cheryl Milnes by name. So I was being compared to him at that point.
That's very flattering. That comment leads perfectly for me into my next question to you. I believe that your professional debut was singing Schaunard in La Bohème for San Diego Opera, as you just mentioned, with none other than Luciano Pavarotti singing Rodolfo, closely followed by Figaro in Rossini's Barber of Seville at Washington National Opera at the age of 23, for which you received a fantastic review from Martin Bernheimer, published in the New York Times, and later on the back of the International Herald Tribune. How was it handling this kind of pressure at such a young age when, again, most singers are usually just starting a master's degree or artist diploma?
Well, I mean, sometimes I felt for sure like I was in the eye of a storm. And I think what people nowadays, certainly any young listeners that you have, they don't really understand because of social media that you had to get publicity. You had to kind of have a publicist. Everything depended on who your agent was, I think more than it does now. And I happened to be from Washington, D.C. I happened to have this success doing Barber. And because Bernheimer gave me this review that mentioned Cheryl Milnes, that my teacher framed and gave to me later as a gift, and that I know you've seen it, it's hanging in my office. But it just by fluke, it wound up being the review and my picture on the back cover of the Herald Tribune. So also very close to that time, I made my debut in Europe and my debut in France singing Pearl Fishers at the Opera Comique in Paris. And so I had these three things happen that gave me lots of attention. So to sort of unpack it, the thing with San Diego, Luciano was extremely nice to me. And I met my friend, Madeline Renee, at that time. She was one of the Mimis. And I also got very good reviews from the guy in Los Angeles. So it just sort of buoyed me and gave me a big push. And of course, I learned a lot from watching Luciano and how he handled the public. And also, he was much more interested in tenors than he was in other baritones. But he definitely paid attention to what was happening with me. And when I saw him years later in Pesaro, when I was singing with the Rossini Festival there, he was also extremely nice to me and said that he was glad things were going well for me and that sort of thing. And the barber was just, I never to this day undervalue the importance in my life of having a big success in my hometown. It was such a success the first year. They revived it the following season. So I wound up at that age having 25 performances of The Barber of Seville in less than 12 months with great reviews in the Terrace Theater in the Kennedy Center. I could see my dad's office building from the top of the Kennedy Center and my whole family could come. And I know how so many artists suffer who are very successful people who have successes in foreign countries, but don't always have that experience in their hometown in front of their family. So I was very fortunate. The people that I worked with were extremely kind to me, even though I was so young and I had traveled with my parents quite a bit. So the traveling thing didn't bother me. And my mother, bless her, did not make me frightened of traveling by myself. But now that, I don't know, now that I'm older and I'm more like the age my parents were when all this craziness was happening to me, they were really supportive and never said, oh my gosh, maybe you shouldn't go off to Paris for 2 months to do a job at this age. So I took it very seriously. And I also was very fortunate for my theater training and my acting training. And of course, we did all this staging for the Boheme in San Diego and Luciano got there and just did his own thing. So thank goodness I had improv and I had spent 5 years doing improv and I knew how to find my light. I knew how to get makeup on my face, all of those things. And my big mentor from high school only just recently passed away in his late 80s, had a lovely long life. His name was Gene Morrill, and he taught me all of my theater skills, really.
It sounds like you had everything behind you, all the opera 101, all the theater 101 traits, right, to kind of get through that. I'm just so curious, did Pavarotti say anything to you on that Boheme as a piece of advice or is anything that you remember in particular?
Wow. I mean, I remember him just being, Domingo has this too, where they just walked in and it was like light was coming off of them. I'm not a person who particularly believes in auras or things like that, but Beverly Sills, Placido, Luciano just had this neon kind of around them and it was palpable. And I was also very fortunate and humbled that I right away got to sing with a whole lot of my idols. San Diego, Tito also put me on a Verdi concert. And on that concert was also Teresa Berganza and Joan Sutherland. And Joan Sutherland, I was meant to sing Imazna Dieri with her in San Diego, but Glyndebourne offered me Così fan tutte in their festival. So I asked Tito to release me. I'm very happy that I got to sing with Carol Van Essen, Dolores Ziegler, and go to Glyndebourne. And it was my debut in England was Mozart. I was very happy about that. But in retrospect, I'm really sorry I didn't get to sing with Sutherland. But she came up behind me at one point, and while I was watching the concert, I think I was watching Teresa Berganza singing the Habanera, and somebody said over my shoulder, my husband said that you sang a really good rehearsal last night, and I turn and I'm eye to eye with Joan Sutherland. So I was completely a fanboy for these people, and they were all really nice to me. Luciano paid attention to me. There was so much going on, and he had really at the height of everything at that time. So there was a lot of just stuff going on around him. So honestly, I don't remember a particular exchange with him other than that he was extremely nice to me. And I have a couple of pictures of him looking at me oh, wow. while we're performing and he's looking right at me. So he clearly thought I was somebody to keep an eye on.
Well, that's amazing. And obviously, it sounds like he provided the kind of energy that was inspirational to people that actually made them do their best as opposed to intimidating them. I'm getting that sense, right? When you talk about this aura.
And the other thing about him that really impressed me, because my dad was the head of a labor union and I had been around a lot of politicians and I had been around the Kennedy family and I met a couple of presidents while I was in high school. I sang for Nixon and I sang for a few different people. But the thing really less that impressed me with Luciano was his devotion to the public. I think that he lived for that feedback from them. And he would go after the performance, they'd set up a table with, you know, with his towel and the water bottle, or probably back then it was probably a pitcher of water and a glass. And he would sit literally for two and a half hours and sign autographs and talk to every person, kiss every baby. And he was a teacher to me in how to treat and respect the public, because personally, I was always a little bit shy, more comfortable being a persona on stage. And I'm one of those performers who's more quiet and more shy about that when I come off the stage. So it's just a different kind of approach. So that, I think, was the thing about Luciano that really impressed me the most.
Sounds like quite a gregarious and generous ambassador and human being. Amazing that you worked with him so young. We talked about this, that, you know, the review in your studio of the Figaro, and in your home, you have many posters of productions that you've participated in over the years. And I remember when I first saw these, my jaw dropped. The places you've sang, the people you've sung with, the shows that you have been in over your career, it's quite amazing. And I don't think many people actually really know this. I mean, your close friends and colleagues would, but can you maybe take us through some of the most memorable experiences that you've had in opera regarding productions and colleagues and places and people you've shared the stage with?
Wow. Well, thank you for that question. There's a lot.
I know it's
that.
A big question. We're going to be question. Here 3 hours from now.
I would say I'm very happy that I have this poster collection, and I've moved a couple of times in the last 20 years, you know, most recently when I moved to Vancouver. So shipping them and boxing them and packing them and everything, it's been quite a commitment. But I do have almost 40 years. I think now I have 37 years of posters. It was a very popular thing for the theaters to print these posters out. I have one from Vancouver Opera when I sang Barber of Seville here in, I think, 91. And I'm very happy that I have them. And a friend of mine had gone to a garage sale while I was in college and found a score of Tristan, I want to say Sandor Konya or Lawrence Melchior or someone very famous tenor. And he had written into the front cover of his score all of the performances, all of the people that he had sung with in the front of his score. And my friend and I were so impressed. And like I said, I'm such a fanboy and I love singers. I started doing the same thing. So the front two pages of my Barber of Seville score, after 223 performances, I stopped keeping notes. But my Bohème score, many of my scores have those notes in it. The thing at my Met debut that was amazing for me was that I got to be in that carriage for Manon Lescaut. The Manon was Mirella Franey, and I was a big fan of hers. And I got to sit knee to knee with her in this little tiny carriage next to Italo Taio, who is a very famous Italian bass, to make my entrance at the Met. That meant a great deal to me. And I had sung with Franey quite a bit. I sang Romeo and Juliet with her and Alfredo Kraus in Chicago. And she was somebody that I just sang with often. So I was around her and her husband, Nikolai Gyarov, a lot. And I sang with him a lot. And one of my strongest performance memories was doing Rodrigo and Don Carlos in Hamburg. And the tenor was Giacomo Aragal, the bass was Nikolai Gyarov, and the mezzo was Grace Bunbury. And I'm sorry, I don't remember who the soprano was. But in that fashion of the theater at the time, they would tab the curtains and you take curtain calls after your aria. So even though I had just died as Rodrigo, and I'm surrounded by Gyarov, I'm laying on the floor dead, and I have Gyarov and Aragal singing over me. And I got four curtain calls after my aria. And with that group of people, that was an amazing experience. And at my Met debut as well, my mom was there, and in the balcony, I got her great seats in a box in the theater. And after the performance, I wanted her to meet Placido, because I had sung with Placido in Chicago. And I sang Lucia with him and Editha Gruberova. And Placido was always extremely kind to me. So I said, Mom, you've got to come and meet Placido. And she said, I know Placido. So it turns out, I found out later, that he was in the same box as my mother. He bought her champagne at the interval. He told her she must be so proud of her son. And so my memory of that was the impact that it had on my mother for that night to have been with him. And he was so kind to her. But yes, I'm very fortunate. I got to sing maybe the shortest Lucia ever when I sang in Central Park Lucia with Alfredo Kraus and Mariella De Villa, who for me was the best bel canto diva of the century, no question. I'm sorry, Maria Callas fans. I loved Callas as a dramatic soprano, but Mariella De Villa was the best Lucia I ever sang with. In my opinion, she was better than Gruberova. She was better than June Anderson or Ruth Ann Swenson. But Mariella De Villa was a goddess, just a goddess. So we go out there under this thing. Paul Plischko was the bass, and maybe Eduardo Müller maybe was conducting. And this huge storm happened. There was 100 or 120,000 people in Central Park. And this great thunderstorm happened. And right after my duet with Lucia, I sang my aria. She sang her aria. She and Kraus sang the duet. And then after our duet, I got most of my role sung. And then we had to cancel the performance because they thought we'd get electrocuted. So that was an exciting night. It could have been called Enrico di Lammermoor instead of Lucia. I'm sure I'm forgetting things, but those are the things that are coming to mind at the moment.
Oh my God, that's amazing. I love it. Enrico. Wow. Well, I'm sure we'll keep talking. And if any other memories of exceptional experiences pop up, let me know. My next question, you've talked about some people already, but who are the people that have influenced you the most?
I would say that, and also in reference to the other question, I got to stand on the stage in Chicago when I was singing there. We were triple cast in Trovatore. I was triple cast with Piero Cappuccilli and Leonucci and me. And so I got to stand there and watch them work and watch them use their bodies and watch them sing. And I had the same experience when Romeo and Juliet with Alfredo Kraus and Mirella Ferni. We could stand in the wings and I could be 8 feet or 10 feet away from them. And so for me watching, I think it's also part of the reason why I think I'm a good teacher is that I think that I was always watching what other artists were doing. And I learned a great deal from watching and having that experience of being on stage with those people, with Carreras and with Domingo. And I was double cast with Carreras as Don José, actually later when I started singing as a tenor. And so I would say those people, but certainly John Moriarty. Certainly my voice teacher, Armin Boyajian, he is part of the New York establishment, but he was famous for lots of basses. He was Sam Raimi's teacher and Paul Plischka's teacher, Mignon Dunn's teacher. Judy Force had a few lessons with him too. And so he was my teacher for almost 30 years. And actually, I only just stopped going to him because of distance. If I needed to go and get an oil change or a tune-up, I would go back to Armin now. He's still very active.
That's quite amazing, actually. Is he doing the Zoom teaching, do you think, these days?
I don't know if he's doing Zoom teaching. I got a really nice Christmas card from him last year, and he said that he was hearing good things about my teaching. But in a note at the bottom of that Christmas card, he said, so glad to hear that the teaching thing is going well for you. And I have 22 people on the Met roster this season. A lot of the Met roster are people he worked with, but we understood each other. And I felt like I had a mentor and somebody whose goal was to improve my singing, and we shared that, and I learned a great deal from him. He never discussed other singers with me, so that was something I learned, and I still try very carefully to do, that I don't discuss my students with other students. And I would say Tito Capobianco influences, but Armin, John Moriarty, Jane Clevitter is a woman who's a repetiteur and a souffleur at the Met. And Jane was my primary coach through all of that time. And she taught me how to learn music. Moriarty taught me how to learn a score, because in that program at Boston Conservatory, we had to make everything very tight musically before we ever did any staging. And John is also a very successful diction coach, but he also wrote a very famous book about diction. And I learned to write the International Phonetic Alphabet from him. And I went to programs that he ran in Central City 2 summers. So I was working with him for maybe 5 or 6 years uninterrupted. So yeah, my influences, of course, those would be the biggest ones, I think.
You mentioned that you worked with Armin for over 30 years. So yeah. I'm guessing that he also then would have helped you when you made the transition from baritone to tenor. And I would love to hear about how that happened. And of course, when you switched to tenor, you took on some of the biggest roles out there, Florestan in Fidelio, Tristan, Siegmund in Die Walküre. I would be so curious to hear how all of that took place. Was this something that you kind of had been feeling for a number of years, or was it something a little more sudden, the change?
I mean, I knew that even in high school that I had a very broad range. I always had almost three octaves. So I always knew that I always had a solid two octaves, A to A, and I could go, so almost three octaves. And now it's almost three octaves that I still have access to. But really, it was more about where the voice sits. So I thought when I was a teenager that this tension or stress that I was feeling on my voice was from people trying to make me a tenor. So I got it in my head, and I was a very successful baritone. So I got it into my head that trying to be a tenor was a bad idea. So I spent all of my 20s not being a tenor, I think. And of course, in retrospect, I think I'm probably a hybrid. I think I probably am something in between. And it's too bad that men can't kind of walk that line when women can be a second soprano and sing some dramatic soprano things and some mezzo things. But men, they sort of make you throw down the gauntlet and say, I'm one or the other. But really, the turning point, and this is completely true, and I'm not just name dropping, has to do with Roberto Alagna. I was doing Traviata in Lausanne with him, and he had just had a huge success doing Alfredo in Traviata at Scala. And we're not that much different in age, but I had been successful so young that I had been around a little bit. And it was the first time I had an Alfredo that I felt like I really could relate to. And physically, he's quite a bit smaller than me. So I felt father-son. It was usually my Alfredos were 20 years older than me. So it was always funny. So I sang Di Provenza, I think, as well as I ever sang in my life in one of those performances. And there was dead silence in the theater. I want to say that it was theatrically driven, but I took it at the moment as disinterest, which of course upsets every artist. So I was seething more and more. And I got to the end of the scene and I, you know, when you're supposed to go, Che dici che ferma, the German. And I went, Che dici che ferma. And I went up to a B flat. And I walked straight downstage and I looked straight at the audience and the curtain. They just tabbed the curtain to come in. And I even kept holding that B flat and I looked under the curtain. And I don't want to tell you what I was really thinking because you might have to edit it, but I was really just so angry. And I stamped back to my dressing room. And this was all because I didn't get the applause I thought I should get after my aria. And Roberto came to me and he said, okay, because I was friends with him and his first wife, Florence. He came to me, said, you're a tenor. I don't care what you think about it. That's what a tenor does. That's how a tenor behaves. And you're a tenor. And during that Traviata, I really had been working to keep sustaining in my mid-range. And the upper range just kept wanting to come in. So I went to Armin. And basically, because I was a completely self-involved singer, it never occurred to me that he worked with other voice types other than mine and Paul and Sam. And so I thought I was going to have to break up with him, you know, break up with him as a teacher. And I said, I think I'm a tenor. And he basically said, thank God you have come around to this way of thinking. He told me he never brought it up with me because he knew how averse I was to it. And despite what everybody says, you know, becoming a tenor, you make all of this more money. The stress and the amount of performances is nowhere near. I could sing a lot more performances as a baritone than I could as a tenor. You can sing every day and every night as a baritone. So there is that myth about it. But he sat down, got kind of challenged, and had told me that years before, I don't know who it was, but he had a tenor who had a difficulty learning music, even though, Les Dalla, you know that never happens. This tenor needed to be spoon-fed and have everything beaten into him. So Armin had, from memory, Valkyrie, Otello, Fidelio. And so I sight-read through Florissant's aria for him, having never really looked at it. And it went extremely well. And he said, really, he had never heard anybody sing it the first time out that well. It just sat right in my voice. And Valkyrie, strangely enough, was a little bit low for me. I liked singing a bit higher. And I also sang through the third act of Otello for him at that time. And my voice just sat there. I was a little bit more like a jugendliche Heldentenor, so a heavy lyric. So when I did do the switch to tenor, ultimately I did more Don José's and more Florestans than anything else. I did do a lot of full rings, but always as Sigmund. So I was only ever in Valkyrie, but I did four or five different rings, Seattle, Frankfurt, but always as Sigmund. And Parsifal was also a little bit low for me. I liked singing Tristan. You know, it's just as an artist, Tristan is one of those things. I think I would give up my entire singing career to have one performance of Tristan, honestly. It's just so moving and so involved. I took 2 years to learn it. I really advocated for myself to get a couple of productions of it. And ultimately, I sang 24 or 25 performances of it. It's a massive thing, so I sang a lot of them. But the switching to tenor was not hard. The hard part was the business part of it. The hard part was re-auditioning for everybody, getting everybody to envision me in a different way. But the singing aspect of it was easy for me.
Yeah, I guess it was a kind of total rebranding, right? I imagine at that stage, you probably had to cancel a few years of engagements in order to set on this new path.
Well, I planned and took only higher things. So I started singing a lot of Eisenstein's. And because on paper, if you don't rearrange the notes, on paper, it's tenor. Like, no question. He's singing right. Higher than Blint in many of those things. So if you don't switch lines with the tenors, and he's doubling Rosalinda and the big finales, singing mm-hmm. B-flats and all that. So he's clearly a tenor, despite the tradition of baritones taking over the part. And yes, so for me, the branding and that aspect of it. So I spent a lot of my time presenting myself to directors and working very hard through all of my 40s, going to the gym and dieting and everything so that I could look like I was still in my 30s. And very recently, I told an agent, because I'm now 63, and very recently I told an agent, I will do parts that are 10 years younger than me or 15 years older, but I am not going to try to look like I'm still in my 30s. Those days, I did that all of my 40s. So I'm not doing that anymore. But the business was good. I got a lot of help from Covent Garden because Peter Katana, who was the casting guy there, who took me to Covent Garden from Hamburg, his dad was an operetta tenor, and he was very familiar with this Fachwechsel. So this changing your Fach, or changing voice type, which was so confusing to North America, did not confuse the Europeans, especially the Germans. They're like, well, of course, you know, baritones become tenors all the time. And it just, I immediately started getting work at Paris Opera and Covent Garden. And I mean, you asked me to share memories. A memory that comes to me right now is that I debuted in a lot of these theaters in both voice types. So I sang at Covent Garden as a baritone and a tenor. I sang at Canadian Opera Company as a baritone and a tenor. And I also sang at Paris Opera quite a bit as a baritone and also quite a bit as a tenor. But my first time, I had done Barber at Paris Opera, I think in 1985, and had a nice success. And my Rosalinda was Suzanne Menzer. And these few years later, when I went to do a new work by Philippe Fenelon called Salambo, I was being introduced by Francesca Zambello, who's now the head of Washington Opera. She was introducing me to the chorus. And the men in the chorus remembered doing that Barber of Seville with me in 1985. And the men in the chorus applauded me and started saying, bravo Figaro, bravo Figaro. So Figaro, you know, followed me for many years. But it meant so much to me that those guys, those other singers, respected me and knew who I was and welcomed me back to Paris Opera as a tenor.
Wow, that is amazing. I was going to talk about some of your former students. I know that this summer, one of your former students, Spencer Britton, was in town, and I had the chance to work with him a couple of times. And he's now off at the program at the Staatsoper in Berlin. And I saw that he's already made his debut as the officer in Ariadne. And he's got a very exciting year ahead and probably a very exciting career ahead. You have many students who are now very successful all over the world and either already singing on stage or in professional training programs. As someone who has been on all the most important stages in the world, your students are so lucky. When it comes down to having a person in front of you in the room, or now at least temporarily on Zoom like we are here, what are the most important traits and skill sets and the kind of thing that you want to pass on? What makes a successful singer? How do you build one?
Well, I keep saying that's a good question, but it is a good question, Les. I think that I teach them not to value gigs that they have. Like, singing under the escalators at the mall is just as important as singing at La Scala. And for some people, a graduating recital at Barnett Hall at University of British Columbia is a debut at La Scala. It's just as important to them. So I love languages. I think 80% of what singers do is declaim text. And I'm very text-driven as an artist anyway, and telling that story. And I think not taking no for an answer, you know, you have to believe in yourself and believe in your own vision. And despite how it looks now, I know that there's not as much work in evidence to people. I think people have to take a more active role in promoting themselves and promoting their work. So all of the people that I know who were successful years ago were also people who were really active in how they were being perceived by the public and how they wanted the audience to think about them and their persona. You asked me about Luciano. You know, he was famous for having a mirror at his record album cover shots because he set the scarves, he set the caps, he set the entire thing. And then he said, now take the picture. And same as Elizabeth Schwarzkopf famously went to a tech rehearsal at Covent Garden with my friend John Copley for a gala that they were doing. And she stood during the lighting rehearsal and she said, okay, I want that. She knew all the technical terms in English for all of the lights, what colors to put them, how to make her look good. And so she wasn't, you know, steaming in her hotel room. She was actually actively participating in how she wanted to be perceived. So I think that for young singers now, they can't ignore that we're in the 21st century. They can't ignore social media. So I do teach them about spin and the content that they put on out there. They have to have a skill set. They have to be able to read music. Your skill set is ongoing. I still don't know Spanish. So I still feel bad that I only speak German, French, and Italian and English, and I should somehow speak Spanish. So I think wanting to improve, acknowledging that you need to improve, and your keyboard skills, your theory. I mean, those are the things. I can't say that's a 1, 2, 3 thing. Some people have more skills in one area. Spencer is a perfect example of somebody who is very good at promoting himself in a good sense. He lets people know what he's doing. And I have another former student, a guy named Johannes Kammler, who is a baritone who's fixed in the ensemble in Munich at the Bavarian State Opera. And he also knows how to present himself to the public. There is not going to be that many people who are successful waiting for the phone to ring. Everybody I know are people who are generating things and generating work. So I think that's what I try to teach them.
Actually, this does go back to the beginning when you said very early on that when you were in high school, you were singing tenor in the high school productions. And then for the Doily Cart type company, you were singing baritone. So the tenor in the morning, which I thought, oh, that's kind of weird. I've always heard people being basses in the morning and the voice getting higher. But anyways, the fact that you've always been so flexible. When it comes to the technique, when you hear somebody open their mouth, can you hear in an instant what they need to do to make that even better or clearer or that sort of thing? Or does it take a little more time in building the relationship?
I mean, I definitely can hear if I hear that there's a natural gift there, or I'm not the kind of person that immediately looks for flaws. One of the things I ask my students to do is to always tell me what they liked in something, what they enjoyed in a performance. There are many people who don't present themselves as the most gifted student who, through hard work and focus, really excel. And I mean, I know you know that too. You can look back over 10 or 15 years and look at the people who are the most gifted and who are the people who are really flourishing. And they're often a different pool of people. So you cannot be a good singer if you don't have the intellectual wherewithal. It's not possible. You have to multitask on many levels. You have to be aware of where you are physically. You have to be aware of the distance between yourself and the conductor. So when I came in for Otello and you sing Esultate and you're unfortunately behind 300 people upstage, and maybe if you're lucky, you can see the conductor's eyes and his hands, you have to adjust for that. So this spatial thing that singers have to do, you have to be proficient with multiple languages. So students who come in from 17 to 21 at a university age must try to absorb as much of this content as possible. And I completely support my theory colleagues and my piano skills colleagues and the language requirements and also attendance requirements for the students, because we're kind of force feeding them information that they're going to be working at their whole lives. And I didn't come to Wagner until I was almost in my 40s or my late 30s. And I did very well with Bellini and Donizetti and Rossini in particular. So my musical journey went for a very long time. But the students who are disinclined to hard work, those are the difficult ones, especially if they're really talented. As you know, the really talented people who don't feel like working are the ones that can get you going.
Oh, very true, right? Yeah.
Honestly, Les, I think I know you have sons, and I just think how fortunate I was that I knew what I wanted to do as a teenager. And I just was never the person who was hanging around in the food court and couldn't decide what to do next. I just wasn't that person. I always knew exactly what I wanted to do. And it was very fortunate. And I advise parents of talented young people who really see themselves or have a passion for something or passion for a life in music or a passion there. I advise their parents. I'm like, this is a blessing. This kind of calling and wanting to do something passionately is a blessing. It really ultimately doesn't matter if you're eating macaroni and cheese or steak. It really matters if you're working at something that you love, and then your life has a whole different kind of meaning.
How very true. Those are very inspiring words, and I think a great way to wrap up. I must say, Patrick, this has been such a pleasure for me. I thought I knew a lot about you, but I heard so many stories and things that I've never heard, and what a treat. So thank you so very much for being my guest today.
Well, thank you, Les. And I'd have to say, just before we stop, I do have extra stories if you ever want to hear about my audition for Peter Brook, for his Peter Brook card.
Oh,
I can share that one with you or your listeners maybe another time, but I'm very excited that Vancouver Opera is planning that Tragédie de Carmen of Peter Brook.
That's right. That's right.
And I will definitely be one of those people watching it, but I didn't ultimately get that job, but I was part of the group of people who auditioned for that project, and he was extremely nice person and was very nice to me. I was disappointed I didn't get to work with him.
Oh, wow. Well, one of your pupils, Ian Clary, who's coming into the program, will be singing Don José in that. And probably when we get closer to the time, I'll do a podcast episode about that. So I must invite you back to maybe share a little bit more about that.
Great. I would love to do that. And thank you so much for today. This was just a pleasure.
It's a pleasure for me. Thank you again, and hopefully see you very soon. Join us next time when we'll have the pleasure of speaking with Canadian mezzo-soprano Mireille Lebel, who will be starring in Vancouver Opera's digital season opening production, La Voix Humaine. Last appearing as Si et Belle in Vancouver Opera's 2019 production of Faust, Mireille grew up in Vancouver and was a member of the Atelier Lyrique de l'Opéra de Montréal before making critically successful debuts with opera companies and orchestras in Europe and North America. Don't forget to subscribe to our fabulous digital season to see Mireille and be ready for La Voix Humaine when it premieres October 24th.
We'd love to hear from you if you have any feedback or suggestions for upcoming guests. You can reach us via email at online@vancouveropera.ca, and don't forget to check out this episode's special features on our website at vancouveropera.ca/offstage.
This has been Vancouver Opera Offstage. I'm your host, Les Dalla. As always, you can keep up to date with Vancouver Opera at vancouveropera.ca, where you can sign up for our e-newsletter, or follow us on social media. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.